Hello everyone, thanks for tuning in and welcome back to TTT, the Talking Transformation podcast brought to you by Tumi. Today we would like to focus on mobility justice, a topic which is essential because mobility enables access to education, to health, to employment and many more things in our daily lives. We much appreciate to talk to the passionate cyclist and human geographer Lukas Neye, today currently working as a research and advocacy manager at Bikes, where he's focusing to amplify local voices and to advance an inclusive transnational vision of the cycling transformation. The planning of public spaces and transport systems still way too often excludes the needs of vulnerable groups like women, children and elderly. Therefore, mobility justice for vulnerable groups in urban environments was a main topic in our conversation with Lukas. Bikes shares this vision of just and equitable mobility and pursues a people-centric approach to cycling promotion. We will hear from his experiences in supporting low-income mothers to access cycling through education and equipment across cities like Istanbul, Mexico City, and Bengaluru. That project also became a segue into the topic of the mobility of care, one which is again often seen as a niche topic, even though care trips make up a massive share in daily mobility. A great example of a city that takes this seriously is Bogota, a city that sees its mandate in being a caring, inclusive and sustainable city for all its inhabitants. Their approach rests on the concept of care blocks, city blocks where care services are accessible within a 15 to 20 minute walk. Lukas also gave insights into involving children in the design and planning of urban environments and how their perspectives can help to solve some on-the-ground challenges. He is reporting about Bike's Bicycle Heroes initiative, but also about using community entry points to engage more easily with people in their daily lives, for instance, through pop-up mechanic labs. This episode shows why transport planning cannot be solved through technical efforts alone, but that it is much more important to understand people and their mobility needs. Lukas walked us through different initiatives which are addressing people's needs in a sustainable way and that contribute to mobility justice.
Yeah. Hi, Lukas. Really great to have you at our Tumi podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Lukas, could you tell us about your role and motivation in initiating the Worldwide Bicycle Mayor Network?
Yeah, absolutely. So I am currently the research and advocacy manager of Bikes, BYCS, which is a small international not-for-profit supporting cycling cultures and supporting cycling advocates worldwide. And they initiated this network, the Bicycle Mayor Network, in 2016 in Amsterdam, where we are based, with the appointment of the first bicycle mayor, Anna Luten. And the role is essentially a figurehead role that is non-politically affiliated, and it is a voluntary role, but it is one that seeks to represent the interests of civil society when it comes to cycling advocacy, planning, and policy. And so this is something that is very important in ensuring that cycling uptake and planning is equitable, and the role of civil society, as Dutch history has shown us, has been fundamental in ensuring the interests of everyone are met when it comes to transportation. So very quickly after this first appointment in 2016, we were surprised to see a very large amount of demand from cycling groups really worldwide, from Mexico City to Bengaluru in India to Cape Town in South Africa, to have also this role in their city and to have a legitimate representative of the cycling activist or advocacy community. And the network has since grown to 135 members in 37 countries. And this is something that shows tremendous growth and has really become a flagship program of my organization and has really marked a shift towards the internationalization of our work, our research and our programs. And to give an example, we had such high demand in India, where we had over 40 network representatives in cities across the nation, that we established our first local office there 2 years ago, and now are taking an increasingly important focus towards the Latin American region, where we're also seeing a lot of demand and growth of that network. And so the cycling advocates are connected really to share knowledge and also feel solidarity in their demands. And we also provide them opportunities to work with Bikes on a more tangible level. So for example, through the local implementation of programs or projects that we secure from Amsterdam. And of course, our team also amplifies their work, and we have some capacity building initiatives. So it's a really sprawling network with a number of different kind of objectives, but everyone is really kind of bound by a demand for safer streets, for cycling for everyone. And that, I think, is quite an inspirational way also of communicating the kind of solution that cycling can offer on a truly global level when thinking about urban transportation.
Really interesting, yeah. And can you tell us what are some current and upcoming activities of the network?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, everyone in the network kind of works on their own local objectives and, of course, support each other and, like I said, share their experience and knowledge. But there are a few coordinated initiatives and moments where the network can come together. One of those moments is happening right now, actually, in Mexico City. There is the World Bicycle Forum, or otherwise known as the Foro Mundial de la Bicicleta, which is a very large activist-led conference that has been active for a number of years and that really brings together advocates and activists, but also practitioners from around the continent to discuss learnings from their work and share good practices. And so a number of Bicycle Mayor Network representatives are meeting there. We also have a staff member that is there, and they will be presenting some of our research at the forum, and they'll be kind of working together to align on some common objectives. We'll also be launching a new international youth campaign with a focus on street activation and access to cycling that will involve a range of members of the network, and will also involve a few that will kind of partner with bikes to implement campaigns locally. So I'm excited about that. And that should be announced in the coming month.
Great. Yeah. Good to know that you're also planning a youth campaign, for example. Yeah. Our next question would be, yeah, that you are highly engaged in working on transportation equity. And could you share here some successful product example?
Yeah, absolutely. So a few years ago, as an organization, we embraced a family-centric approach to cycling promotion to specifically think more about transportation equity. You know, families are very important in the context of active mobility and cycling promotion because of the sheer population percentage they represent. Over 1 billion children live in cities worldwide, and they are cared for by a large portion of the adult population at some point in their lives. And so, you know, despite their prevalence, our public spaces and transport systems too often exclude their needs. And such oversight makes both the care of children difficult and sometimes unsafe, and also threatens children's ability to thrive in play, learning, and proper development in the city. And so we see this as an absolutely critical part of transportation equity. Because the way parents move through the city, and that is very closely related to the mobility of care, you know, which is a mobility that results from all travel from home and care responsibilities, it is also a question of gender equity, because mobility of care is often carried out by women due to an unequal division of household labor. So really ensuring that the transportation of families is equitable connects with a different number of social and environmental targets that we see as absolutely fundamental. And so some examples of initiatives that we have worked on recently are, for example, work that we did with the Bernard Van Leer Foundation in 2022 and 2023 around supporting low-income mothers to access cycling. And we carried out an initiative that in total worked with over 200 families in Mexico City, in Istanbul, and in Bangalore, where through cycling education, but also the provision of bicycles and providing access to the right equipment and materials to start cycling, we attempted to see how cycling could be an empowering force for families and how it could address issues of transport poverty, transport inequity. And we found some really staggering results that I'm sure we can talk about more a little later, but that really show that cycling and working with families has the potential to reduce transport costs, but also to importantly provide a sense of freedom and independence, which is also a fundamental aspect of addressing transportation equity. Another example that I can provide is working again here with women in a European project called Tandem, where we developed an intensive online and offline course to successfully empower a range of cohorts of women who wanted to develop grassroots cycling schools in their communities, kind of for women, by women. And that initiative really recognizes the importance of women in the transport sector and to center their perspectives also in empowering others. And it was an initiative that really sought to ensure that women that want to can confidently champion the cause of cycling in their own cities and work within their communities. And that's kind of a way that we work in the organization and really address kind of the critical issue of the gender gap in cycling, which is a great cause of transportation inequity.
Yeah, interesting. Could you elaborate a little bit more on the initiatives in Istanbul and Bangalore? So where were the challenges and the opportunities you saw there? Maybe where were the differences between, for example, Istanbul and Bangalore?
Yeah, absolutely. Of course, all work, especially with active mobility in public space, is highly contextual. And so we see a lot of variance across geographies and urban contexts. However, we also found some striking similarities. And those mostly came across in the barriers that mothers have when it comes to getting on a bicycle and starting to cycle in their daily life. First of all, cycling skills and confidence are lower for those care trips. Women often lack access to cycles when they are young and may not learn how to confidently start cycling. And there is kind of the misconception that everybody knows how to ride a bike. But especially if you are riding in potentially dangerous traffic conditions with a child on the back of your bike or riding next to you or carrying goods from shopping, for example, it can be very stressful, and skills and confidence were a very large barrier. Of course, also cycling has a negative socioeconomic perception in certain contexts, especially for women, and even more so when riding with children. And so in some contexts, riding a bicycle can be incompatible with caregiver identities or social aspirations. And we saw that a lot in India, for example, in Bangalore, where, you know, the bicycle is seen as the mode of transport either for the very poor or the very rich as a recreational activity, which of course prevents the huge middle to identify with and kind of connect with cycling. And of course, also issues of clothing and garment and gender violence were front and center in a lot of these contexts. This leads to kind of women caregivers and mothers to fear for their personal safety due to that gender violence. And so that's kind of a large barrier that we found really across all three cities in which we work. And then another important barrier is simply the access to proper equipment, which is also something that I mentioned. It's, you know, often scarce and expensive. And in many contexts, it's just not available. And so making sure that there is a way to access, you know, whether it is a safe seat for a child on the back or know how to ride carrying goods, having a bicycle that is fitted to your size, that these are all challenges that we see, especially in emerging economies and that need to be remediated. An example I always like to give is, I think many people now are seeing bike share systems pop up in their respective neighborhoods or communities or cities. And yet it is extremely rare to ever see a bike share system that has a baby seat. Meaning that if you are a parent and you would like to use the bike share system, but you're with your child, you essentially cannot, or you have to use it in a way that is potentially dangerous. So that is, of course, also a So we see a lot of kind of similarities in this context. And of course, you know, traffic safety and inadequate infrastructure is the biggest barrier that, that families face. But also there are some variances. And for example, in Latin America, we are seeing capacity within government that is rapidly increasing and really quite inspirational. And so we see a range of programs targeting families, helping them start cycling. We're starting to see the mobility of care being more accounted for in data collection. And so there are a lot of inspiration examples also that show that some areas are leading on that front. And I'll just end on the example of Bogota in Colombia, which is a leader in cycling, but that has also taken really important steps towards centering care in their urban planning and policy. And I think they're a very inspirational example there.
Yeah, thank you for the background information. Yeah, really inspiring. Your experiences and what you have seen in these different cities. I mean, you have already covered a little bit of the aspects of mobility, of care, but I want to stress a little bit more on this topic again. So can you share some insights on the challenges and opportunities related to the mobility of care and how it contributes to more sustainable urban environments? So maybe this is a more macro perspective now.
No, I mean, it's an important topic and one that we are really still, unfortunately, seeing as emerging. You know, it's a term that was coined by Ines Sanchez de Madariaga, an urban planner from Spain, who coined this term a really short amount of time ago. And as I mentioned, it is related to care trips. And those care trips are associated with unpaid labor performed by people for children and other dependents, including labor related to the upkeep of a household. So accompanying a child to school, going to buy groceries, or dropping off food at your grandparents' or your parents' house. And these trips are not well described in transport literature across all modes, and even less considered by transport policy agendas. And here, I would like to stress that while gender is one of the most robust determinants of transport choice, gender mainstreaming is still not systematically included in transport and mobility planning, and even less so in mobility projects. Something else to think about is that while this is an emerging topic, and often in our work, we face the challenge of stakeholders saying, oh, but this is a niche topic, it is absolutely not a niche topic. Care trips make up a substantial part of all trips in the city. Again, there's limited data about this, but a relatively recent study in Montreal, Canada, indicated that the mobility of care comprises up to 28% of adults' daily mobility. That is absolutely massive. And furthermore, women were found to complete more of this type of trip than men, especially from women of lower income households. And so it's also, again, coming back to transportation equity, a fundamental aspect of our transport planning that we need to address. This number of 28% that I mentioned in Montreal is relatively similar to surveys that have been done in Madrid that found that 30 to 45-year-olds make a similar percentage of trips, so about 30% for care-related activities. But in that survey, women made 40% of their trips for care-related activities, while men only did that for 9%. So you can see, again, how we're connecting here with the topic of family mobility, but also gender and transport planning. And worldwide, going even more to kind of a larger scale, it's estimated that about 70% of the caregiving work in general is performed by women. So, you know, there's a absolutely massive need to think further, to develop more research, and to connect the mobility of care with sustainable transport planning, but also equitable transport planning in a meaningful way, and in a way that involves a range of stakeholders, from policymakers to practitioners to communities, to ensure that that form of mobility is accounted for in the most inclusive manner.
Yeah, really good point. Yeah. Do you have an example for us? Maybe a city which has already stressed on a better gender mainstreaming in their transport policy?
Yeah, there are a few. I think I spoke briefly about Bogota.
Yeah.
I can kind of deepen that example a little bit. The Bogota Secretariat of Mobility, but also together with the District Secretariat for Women, and I think with a range of other actors such as the Inter-American Development Bank, have been starting to study the connection between care trips and bicycle mobility. I think a study that they recently put out, again, in the last few years, this is a very emerging topic, started to really consider the relationship between school drop-offs by bicycle and the mobility of care, and the relationship between gender and mobility. And this has been an extremely inspiring study to kind of sift through, but also in the implementation of the new bicycle share program, which I believe it was only inaugurated last year, implemented by the organization Tembici, a bike share provider in Latin America, has a range of offerings such as cargo bikes, but also standard bicycles with baby seats, electric assisted bicycles, in a real demonstration of a commitment to gender mainstreaming and the mobility of care. At least from what I can tell, it is the only robust bike share program that is so inclusive for families. There are other examples. I think the city of Fortaleza, again in Brazil, but again in the Latin American region, has implemented a bike share system that had a youth or child-centric offering as well. But Bogota is really leading here. And then lastly, their policy around care blocks, where they really want to center neighborhood planning around accessing key care facilities, you know, health centers, nurseries, fresh food, has again shown a real understanding of, you know, how the reality of the urban population lives its life and how, you know, we need to make sure that our planning and our policies reflect the needs of all of our population. So, you know, women, children, men, and all other kind of inhabitants. So yeah, I think that's a strong example.
Nice. Thank you very much for these examples and for the small excursion to the different cities, which are kind of leading maybe in this topic. This is really important, although it's still a niche topic, but it's important. It's getting more and more important, of course.
Absolutely.
All right. So you're also passionate about participatory processes. Can you share examples of successful initiatives or projects where community participation has played a pivotal role in shaping urban mobility policies and infrastructure?
Sure. I can provide a couple of examples that focus on youth perspectives, because I believe children are such an important stakeholder that, you know, often are not heard in those participatory processes. And of course, we're seeing this change a little with the growing child-friendly cities movement, for example, but there's still a long way to go to meaningfully involve children in the design and planning of our urban environments. You know, they have such a unique perspective on how to solve some of our challenges, yet they often go unheard. But I think what's important to remember is that when we meet the needs of children in our cities, our cities are also safer for other more vulnerable groups like the elderly or a disabled population, in addition to, of course, the general population. And also, I think we need to remember that children are some of the most effective spokespeople for change as a result of, you know, not only their influence over their families, but in society in general. The author Tim Gill has very eloquently highlighted that children are indicator species in our cities, and the visible presence of children and really youth of different ages and backgrounds is a sign of kind of the health of our urban environments and our habitats, essentially. And so that's been kind of a core of our programs for the last few years at Bikes. One of these programs that we've led, which involve children in community planning, is the Bicycle Heroes initiative, which uses playful design and co-creation to engage with children in schools from about 8 to 12 years old. And for several years, we've carried out this initiative in several major urban centers in the Netherlands, you know, from Amsterdam to The Hague or Arnhem. And recently, with the support of EIT Urban Mobility, we piloted this initiative in Rome, Dublin, and Lisbon. And the program is quite simple. We have teams go into schools where children learn about the benefits of cycling and the challenges to increase cycling in their neighborhood. And they come up with a few initial ideas to make cycling safer, but also more fun for kids in the city. And they're invited to develop and design their ideas further in kind of a participatory guided workshop. And at the end, a jury of key stakeholders from the city will evaluate their ideas and select a winner. And some participating children are invited to join what we call the youth squad or the hero squad, through which they work with those stakeholders to implement the selected idea and also increase awareness about children's needs when it comes to cycling in their city. And so it's a really interesting and playful way to involve children in the planning process, to make them gain positive associations with cycling and make them feel like they can connect with their neighborhood or in their city, but also really infuse their ideas into the decision-making of the city. And we've seen this through the implementation of, let's say, a school street after a participant really wanted to close down the streets in front of their schools for cars at drop-off and pickup times. But also we've seen children propose ideas for better lit bike paths that were a little bit scary or threatening. And all of these ideas really demonstrate, I think, the possibility for youth perspectives to be better integrated in the city. Just to give another short example, we've started also using schools and daycare centers as what we're calling community entry points. So using programs that involve children to also reach parents and educators, and really looking at conducting engagement where people spend their time. And so what better than educational facilities to reach meaningfully residents and ask them what their needs are and what their challenges are. And after conducting a pilot program with toddlers in the Netherlands, we were able to deploy a pop-up mechanic lab in front of the school so that the parents, low-income parents for the most part, could get their bicycles fixed in front of the school while picking up their kids. And that was a way to kind of get them back on their bicycles. So there's a lot of very interesting examples that show that if you're really working with children and through children, also their families, community participation can have a real tangible effect on getting people to change their mobility habits, but also getting cities to better integrate the needs of vulnerable groups in their thinking and in their decision making.
Nice examples, really, really nice. All right. Lucas, given your background in anthropology and urban geography, how have these disciplines influenced your approach to engaging diverse stakeholders in discussions about transportation cultures and mobility justice?
It's an interesting question, I guess, that relates more to, I think, also my background.
Mm-hmm, yes, of course.
Which is in the humanities and more specifically in the social sciences. You know, so really, I am not a technical practitioner. I have developed knowledge with a strong focus on how people engage with the urban environment, how they relate to each other, and how they are affected by, you know, a range of social, environmental, and economic determinants. And I've always grounded this work, and the organization I'm currently working for, Bikes, has always also grounded this work in kind of understanding the question of social justice and understanding how people face a range of quite crushing inequities based on the mere place or social conditions that they are born in and in the ways that they can travel to. And when thinking about mobility, this is really fundamental. I think the question of mobility justice is quite simple, ultimately. It is a vision for a world that is rooted in social justice, where people simply feel safe existing on streets and can build lives experiencing the full joy of movement, regardless of their religion, their background, their physical ability, or their racial background or their ethnic background. And what is so interesting with mobility justice is that it has been both theorized at the street level by cycling activists such as Adonia Lugo, but as well as at kind of a more macro level by scholars like Mimi Scheller. And in my role at Bikes, I have to engage with a wide range of stakeholders, you know, from activists to academics and city representatives, but also multilateral development agencies and even school children, like I was just saying. And I think anthropology and in general, a focus on people has helped to communicate the fact that, of course, we must not remember that when we are planning our cities and when we are thinking about our mobility systems, we are ultimately working for people, and that their experience is highly subjective and highly complex. And so when we are making decisions, we cannot solely rely on technical aspects, and we have to connect different disciplines. I think it's been interesting to see a renewed energy into integrating the social science in urban planning. It is absolutely necessary, in my opinion. Of course, I'm a little biased being more of an anthropologist and geographer, but I do think that when I have worked on projects with different stakeholders where there is a, of course, high technical capacity that can really conduct the needed technical assistance, but there are also researchers that are taking the time to speak with people and to understand their needs and to integrate their needs in a meaningful way, again, in the planning process, then the project is more successful. And it is necessary because mobility cultures do not simply emerge out of a change in infrastructure. This is something that we hear a lot, especially in regards to cycling, you know, this idea of build it and they will come. But an example that I'll give is, you know, even with the best piece of protected bicycle infrastructure outside of your door, if you were not raised in a way to identify with cycling, if you were not raised and taught how to cycle, or if you cannot afford to buy a bicycle, you will not use that infrastructure. And so connecting, you know, the built environment and the needed changes in the built environment with more of a cultural approach and a social approach is absolutely necessary. And it's something that, you know, in the 4 years that I've been working for this organization, I've seen grow. And I think more and more there is attention that is paid to the kind of the social side of mobility culture. And we're seeing a healthier mix between, of course, yeah, again, changes in infrastructure, but also a renewed attention to what we call the human infrastructure of cycling and transportation.
Thank you for your personal insights here. Also really interesting and good to know. All right. Our last question would be, in your experience, what are the key arguments that persuade local governments to invest in bike infrastructure and mobility initiatives?
Yeah, I love that question because, unfortunately, I think there's no textbook answer. I think it really depends on the context, but there are a few elements I think that should always be weighed and considered. And here I will mention the health aspects first for a reason, because I think that more and more we are seeing the arguments to promote healthier communities in a really successful manner when it comes to cycling and the promotion of active mobility. I think, you know, there's a crisis of sedentarization, of air pollution, that really getting people out of their cars and promoting cycling and walking in public transportation can start meaningfully addressing. I think that's something that we're seeing, you know, stakeholders really understand. And to give you an example, I mean, the World Health Organization, for example, is one of the leading organizations in terms of the narrative that they have about cycling. They really understand how cycling can help address a range of health crises. So that's the first kind of argument that I think is starting to really connect with governments. And of course, safety is another important question. I think all local municipalities and government stakeholders are acutely aware of the high volume of traffic violence that our car systems and car cultures and car-centric cities have created. It is still, you know, worldwide the leading death for young people, the cause of death for young people. And I think we're starting to really understand that we need to think of the way we move in our cities in a different way to improve safety. And what I also like to mention is public joy. I think we need to think about mobility not just as a way of getting from A to B, but also as a place to experience the city and be part of a neighborhood and be part of a community, and connecting active travel with just urban well-being, which is also something that local governments connect with. This idea of improving the conditions of life in the city is absolutely essential. And then the list goes on, but maybe I'll also end on the economic argument, which is also, I think, something that is starting to take hold. There are a few organizations that are kind of looking into the bikeonomics and the benefits of building bicycle infrastructure in terms of health cost saves, but also in terms of other kind of elements related to access to economic opportunity, employment, cycling industry. And that's something that also we see stakeholders beginning to kind of understand. It's important to remember that cycling infrastructure is among the cheapest infrastructure to develop and one that has kind of some of the best benefit cost ratios. And so it's important to think about that as well when asking for change. And then, you know, to tie this all together, the environmental question is something that I think definitely in a range of geographies, we're starting to pay attention more closely to the potential effects of active mobility in facing the climate crisis. And that is, of course, something that should be front and center of the narrative in parallel with a lot of the other factors that I just mentioned.
Lucas, thanks a lot for your time to join us and share your vision and your, of course, experiences with me and also with the other listeners. It was really great and fun talking to you today.
Yeah, great. Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Okay. So, I will say goodbye and hope to have another opportunity to meet you.
Likewise.
Thank you, Lucas and Stephanie, for this insightful interview, touching upon several aspects of mobility justice in the city. We hope you enjoyed today's episode and learned a lot about the challenges and opportunities of making mobility more inclusive. Thanks for tuning in, and until next time.